sound check okay? Did you finish everything on sound check while we were talking? That's why we started off talking, because he was doing sound check.
Okay, perfect. And I sound fine? I'm good?
Yep, you're good. All right, we're going to start right now. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Crime Prevention For Real. I'm your host, Stephanie M. Sawyer, founder and board chair of the Sentencing Foundation, also known as TSF. TSF is the logistical support for resource-based sentencing and supervision, which is indeed a program that can deliver real solutions to crime. So this program is actually designed and able to deliver crime prevention for real. Today on our program, we are lucky to have our executive director, the Sentencing Foundation's executive director, Deanna Davis, and also my former law clerk and somebody that I just absolutely love. So welcome to the show, Ms. Davis.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
So I wanted to tell everybody, like, it was kind of like the most organic thing when we actually met, when I actually interviewed you. And I want to pull it back a little bit, just a step before the fact that I met you. Tell our listeners how you came to hear about the position of the law clerk and why you applied, because my goodness, you were making more than my law clerk was, the law clerk position paid.
Absolutely. So at the time, I was looking for a law clerk position, but just not any law clerk position. I was looking for someone whose ideals align with my own. And, you know, being a African-American Muslim woman, I do know that I'm not everyone's cup of tea. I'm going to be very honest.
I said, you're my cup of tea.
Well, thank you. So I decided, you know, that I was looking for a law clerk position, but I would first need to know that the judge I was working for would be someone that was like-minded. I did see that Judge Sawyer had a position available, and that led me to do a little bit of background research and see what platform and, you know, ideals Judge Sawyer ran on. And, you know, I had to think, hey, does this align with what I'm looking to get into in the criminal justice arena and, you know, my future plans in the legal field? From doing my research, I decided that it would probably be a good fit. I submitted my, you know, application and resume, and, you know, things went on from there.
You know, what's interesting, though, I remember when my then secretary, Ms. Anderson, told me about having met you, virtually met you, because hadn't physically met you. And she came to me and she was so excited. She said, I think I have a perfect fit. She has a social work background. She does social work stuff. That's, you know, that's what we do with, you know, with resource-based sentencing and supervision. And I just think she would be a great fit, but I'm not sure. And it was right around the pandemic, but I'm not sure if she wants to take the vaccine. And I said to her, she said, will you talk to her anyway? I said, why are you going to set me up to fall in love with somebody that I'm not allowed to hire? Absolutely not. And then she told me she let you know, and that very same day you went and got the vaccine. I said that was a sign, because if you remember, we had to wait a couple of weeks until you had the second dose before I could hire you. And I said, no, absolutely. She's somebody worth waiting for.
Absolutely. And I'll actually add that not only was I opposed to taking the vaccine, you know, prior to the position with you, I had actually quit a job because of the vaccine.
Wow.
Prior to
now, that
with
part
you.
I didn't know you quit.
I quit working at a hospital for that very reason.
And look, and I said to myself, it's not necessarily my rule, but as a sitting judge at the First Judicial District, if that's the First Judicial District's policy, I'm like, why am I going to fall in love with somebody that I'm not allowed to hire? That just seemed dumb to me.
Yes. I mean, I was fully on board. So I had to let you know, I'm going to do this. And it's solely to work for you.
And I felt so honored and special. But then I tell you, within 2 weeks of it, I was like, oh my God, did we make the right decision? But I want to let the listeners get a bit more information about your background. So you are born in West Philadelphia, but you attended Girard College. Tell our listeners a little bit more about why Girard College is different, because you were there in the fifth grade and you stayed there till, I think, high school. So tell us a little bit about Girard College, why you chose to go there.
Sure. I was always a bit of a gifted kid. I was skipped once. My mom allowed me to be skipped once, but not twice. So school was always something I was in love with. I did not have the, I guess, the family structure and background, whereas though academics was very important. Mm-hmm. Academics was very important for me, even as a young child. So when the opportunity presented itself, my mom said, hey, I don't see you thriving at your local public school. Let's look at some other schools. Girard College was the only school that was a boarding school, and that was very important to me because, as I stated before, I didn't quite have an ideal family structure. And I figured, hey, if I'm living at school, I already love school, this should be wonderful. Oh. So, you know, I visited Girard College. I stayed overnight. And at that time, I said, well, hey, if I can do this overnight visit, you know, and I still like it in the morning, then I'm definitely coming to this school. You know, I took an entrance exam, passed it with flying colors, and I said, Mom, this is where I want to go. It was at Girard College that, you know, my love for learning was expanded. It also was an eye-opener because it exposed me to so many different things that I wasn't seeing at home. The idea of just structure and sitting at a table having meals with a family, the idea of having a nightly routine that would make things much easier in the morning. It was these small things that made a huge difference in my life that I didn't have going on at home. Most importantly, at Girard College, they instilled in us core values. They have very specific core values, which are respect, responsibility, integrity, courage, and compassion. And, you know, I like to think that those core values are still very present in my life now. They are, you know, what helped guide me to where I am now. And I have a lot of gratitude for Girard College, the institution itself, my peers who I still consider family to this day, the teachers. It was just an overall wonderful experience for me.
That's excellent. You know, I've never really heard people talk that glowingly about their elementary and high school, right? You might hear that about high school because, you know, maybe that was when they had their fun and you know, maybe this person was the, I don't know, the prom king or queen or something, you know, like that, and on a social level. But in terms of the character building things that you just discussed, you don't usually hear people talk about their elementary and high schools like that. That's excellent. I'm just struck by that. You know, so what about, you know, your children? Why did they not attend Girard College?
So honestly, at Girard College, there has been sort of a shift in policy. It is not the Girard College that I attended. There are a lot of things that's different. I will also add that at Girard College, the idea is that they're serving underprivileged children, meaning, you know, either you have an absent parent or you fall below a certain income level. Right now, my kids would not qualify to attend Girard College. However, in looking for their schools, because they do attend private school, some of those core values and some of the things I experienced there were at the forefront when choosing schools for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, you alluded to not having the ideal background, and I don't know how much of it you want to get into, but I think it's worth our listeners knowing. You know, you're the executive director of the Sentencing Foundation. You work. You're a lawyer. You have multiple degrees, which we'll get into. And so I don't know that some of our listeners could identify with you, but if they knew you like I did, they would know that you are certainly identifiable. Like so, if you didn't mind, give us a little bit more information about what you meant by not having the ideal background.
Sure. I don't mince words in saying that each male in my family, outside of my male children, of course, have been involved in the criminal justice system at some point or another. They are currently incarcerated on parole or probation or deceased as a result of some criminal activity. So from a very young age, my father was incarcerated when I was 2. For a third degree murder. And, you know, going on from there, my uncles, who I lived in the home with, they were in and out of prison and jail for, you know, drug offenses, gun charges and things of that nature. The two uncles specifically, who were twins, one was murdered in 2004. The other is currently serving a 25 to 50 year prison sentence for an attempted murder. I could go on and on. Like I said, all of the males in my family have been involved in the justice system. I can recall as a child, maybe 8 or 9 years old, one of my uncles calling me, who was arrested in Chester, Pennsylvania, and having me call a bail bondsman at 8 or 9 years old. Wow. Like, so it was always something that I thought to be normal, honestly, because it just went on so much. I just thought that, hey, the men get arrested and they go to jail and they come back home, and this is the cycle, and this is what happens in the hood, so to speak.
How did you escape it?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
How did you escape it? Like, how did you just intrinsically get away from that kind of thing? Would you think that was Girard College or?
Yes. So I oftentimes think back to, hey, if I hadn't gone to Girard College, what would my life be like? Mm-hmm. I honestly think my saving grace was Girard College. It allowed me to separate what I deemed to be my norm from what was the actual norm, and, you know, what should be going on within a familiar structure. Mm-hmm. That honestly was my saving grace. So while I was there during the week and I lived this, you know, lovely life, I still went home on the weekends and had to deal with these type of things, you know, the criminal interactions of my family members. But again, I was able to separate myself. I mean, I honestly recall my uncle taking me back to Girard College on a Sunday night and us stopping at a gas station, and someone, you know, he sees that, you know, he's beefing with, and as we are headed down the street, I hear gunshots. Like, wow. These are all things that happen. You know, on the weekends. So it was really like I was living in two different worlds. But for me, I was, you know, pretty smart, and I was able to differentiate what should be happening and what shouldn't, and how I wanted to live my life.
Wow, wow. And that's why you're the strong lady that I met. It feels like I've known you forever, but it really hasn't been that long. It's only been a few years. From there, you went to Georgia Southern University, and you were only there for a brief period of time. Tell us about, one, your experience there, and two, you know, what personal challenges brought you back.
Sure. I'll first start by saying Southern hospitality is a real thing. Everyone I met in Georgia, they were wonderful. They were so inviting. They were so pleasant. That was my first time going that far south. And, you know, it was my intent that I would do my undergrad, you know, years there, you know, and go from there. However, I went down in August when school started. Literally, I was there for 2 weeks, and my uncle, one of the twins, he was murdered. Mm-hmm. That made it very difficult. I mean, coupled with the fact that it was out of state, which was out of state tuition, which was pretty expensive, and coming from a family who didn't have great means, it was really difficult for me to, you know, make a sustainable living down there by myself. So ultimately, after one semester, I did return to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And when you came to Philadelphia, you finished out, I think you started a temple at that point when you came back?
Yes, so I started at Temple.
My alma mater, by the way.
Yes. I started at Temple in 2005. I was at Temple. I was still, you know, going through losing a family member. And, you know, as you know, I went back to live at home, which again was that family structure that wasn't ideal. You know, I graduated from Girard. It was no going back to Girard.
Right.
So, you know, things were a little dicey there. You know, while I was attending school at Temple, I wasn't doing the best that I could do, given my, you know, home situation. So I did attend Temple in 2007. You know, I had my first child. And I was still going to school when I had my first child. However, when he was 1 year old, he was diagnosed with cancer, which kind of put a halt to my studies.
That must have been so scary.
It was, but I'm also the type of person that I'm always thinking, okay, well, this is what he has. What do we do next? Everyone reminds me that I did not cry one time from the time he was diagnosed through the whole ordeal, him completing chemo, getting surgery. I never shed a tear because for me, again, it was, what do we do next?
That's actually incredible. I can believe it, though. But that's actually incredible. Most people would have lost their minds, you know, being a single parent at that time and still trying to navigate school and still trying to navigate this dicey home life. And you still were able to navigate your son, who was only 1 year old, going through cancer treatment. That's actually relatively incredible. You do know that.
Thank you. I mean, I've heard that, but again, my mindset is always, hey, okay, so this is what I have. This is what I was given. What's next?
You know what, though? And I got to tell you, it's one of the things I say in the courtroom all the time. You've probably heard me say it a few times, is that people keep on trying to, you know, move from where they want to be as opposed to from where they are. And they lament over not being where they want to be so much that they're not able to navigate from where they are, and they shoot themselves in the foot. And so, you know, while that is the way to go as a human being, it's just an incredible to me. You know, I try to imagine, because I was a single parent, as you know, and I try to imagine how I would have navigated one of my kids to go through cancer treatment while I'm still figuring out how to pay bills and while I'm still in a dicey life environment. I still haven't gotten my degrees. You know, I'll be honest with you. I take my hat off to you, because I made a promise to my mother that I didn't have kids till I got my degrees, because I don't know how I could have handled all of that. I guess with adversity breeds strength is one of the main things that I think of when I hear all of that stuff going on. But Deanna, honestly, I still think it's incredible. When I was actually going back through your bio and the things that I know about you, I was writing these questions down to myself, and I said, wow, she is really an impressive young lady, boy, I tell you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
That brings us to the other part, and I talked to you about this before we actually got on the air, because it's a very deeply personal part. In addition to all of that, you also navigated through a domestic violence situation, and I don't know how much of it you want to share with our listeners, but I know that there are people out there that are navigating through issues of domestic violence, because if you look at the numbers and see how prevalent it is, I'm sure that there are people out there listening that have gone through this. And so what would you like to share with our listeners about what kind of experiences that you had in this regard?
Sure. So my children's father, my children have the same father. My youngest son was born in 2010. So from, you know, 2008, I would say, right after my older son finished chemotherapy treatments, until about mid-2010, I did suffer from domestic violence. It was a situation in which I feel, as I stated before, I've always been a very strong-minded person, strong-willed person. I envisioned what I wanted my life to be. I think that was intimidating for the person I was with, because they didn't quite have many things going for themselves. And that turned into them being physically violent. I've never, and I don't want to sound, you know, too crass, but I've never been a pushover. I certainly am going to fight back. It was just that I didn't win those fights. As a female, fighting a grown man, that usually doesn't fare very well.
Usually the woman would lose. That's correct.
Yes. So, I mean, it was one of those situations, and not to, make light of the fact that it was domestic violence. There was a situation, and this is the situation where I decided, you know, that's it. My younger son was about 3 months old. This was in 2010. And at that point, you know, we got into some verbal dispute. I personally didn't think it was that serious. You know, I'm in the shower, and here, you know, the shower curtain gets pulled back, and I'm punched in the face. I mean, my tooth went through my lip, and, you know, you see me, I have a scar on my lip. What that's from. And at that point, you know, I have to go to the hospital. I have to get stitches. Police are called, and that was the end of the situation. It was like, okay, enough is enough. I've always been self-sustaining. So at that point, I was out on my own. I was making my own living. I was taking care of my kids. It was like, okay, I can do this on my own. Like, what's going on here? So yes, that's kind of how that situation went.
Well, you know what, though? I'm glad. I thank you so much for sharing that very intensely personal kind of interaction. You know, but I think where a lot of the complexity happens that you were, I don't want to say lucky, because, you know, you worked hard to be in that position to call your own shots. You know, I think a lot of folks that stayed too long at the rodeo show, if you will, I think a lot of those folks rely economically on the abuser. Right?
Yes.
When they rely economically on the abuser, they say, oh, if I don't forgive him or her, you know, you never know. But if I don't forgive the abuser, if they are your economic source of how you eat every day, that makes it so much harder to logistically make a plan to leave.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because one of the things that when I knew that was a component of, you notice I never really asked a whole lot of questions about it, because I know that it's intensely personal, and the reason that I'm asking them now is because I know that there are people that are listening that go through some of these things and they don't know how to move forward from it. But I gotta say, you know, to go through those kinds of things and to be, you know, a woman relatively very young, if you ask me, and you're not anywhere near my age, you know. So, but to have those kinds of accomplishments, to know that you can, you know, navigate in that way, it's got to be empowering.
It's very empowering. And looking back on it, you know, I'm proud of myself for, you know, all I accomplished and all of the adversity that I went through while accomplishing many of these goals. I mean, I can't think of a stretch of, what, 2-3 years where there wasn't some sort of huge adversity that could have possibly, you know, ended everything I had going. You know, but I managed to work through it.
And so after that situation where you found the strength to walk away from that toxic situation, you still hadn't finished school yet. Is that true?
I'm sorry, what was that? It kind of cut out a bit.
I said through navigating that very toxic situation, you still hadn't finished school yet.
I hadn't, and I failed to mention this, but when my son was going through chemotherapy, there was some mix-up with financial aid, and they said you did not make enough credits to receive financial aid for the next semester. I believe it was in the fall of 2008. So, I mean, at that point, you know, I was on my own taking care of my kid, but I didn't have enough to pay tuition from out of pocket for a full semester.
Sure.
So at that point, I stopped going. And in my mind, it was, when you have enough money, when you save enough money to go back and pay on your own, then from there on out, you know, you're going to show out, meaning like you're going to get the highest grades. It's go time.
Right, right,
so,
right.
You know, working through that whole domestic violence situation, and spring of 2011 is when I finally saved up the money. I went back, and the rest of undergrad, which was about 2 more years, straight A's.
Wow. You know what, though? I'm actually not surprised, because I know who you are as a human spirit as well as a person. But it's a heck of a story, you got to admit, you know? I was looking at some of the other paperwork, the information that I wanted to kind of go into with you. I see on 2011, when you did return to school, you participated in a program called Inside Out Prison Exchange. Tell us about that.
I did. That was an eye-opening program. So Lori Pompa, she is the founder of Inside Out. I took the course at Greaterford. And at the time, I almost didn't get in because my stepdad was being housed there when the class started.
Wow.
And they initially told me, no, I couldn't go inside because I had a relative there or a family member there. And, you know, she fought for me and they allowed me to do the class, which was amazing.
What kind of class was it?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What kind of class was it?
So it was, you know, restorative justice. We did a lot of workshops where, you know, some of our of the outside students like myself, we partnered with the inside students to come up with what we thought would be a good model for restorative justice. So, you know, it was a lot of criminal justice related material that we went over in the class. But what I think was most profound is how some of the inside students thought and perceived, you know, the criminal justice system to be. That class, I guess, it meant a whole lot to me. Like I said, I had many family members in prison, although I wouldn't say they made the best use of their time there. Some of the guys that were in the class with me, it made it eye-opening and to see that, you know, there are people in here who are working to be rehabilitated and to come out and, you know, make a living for themselves.
How long were you involved in the Inside Out prison exchange program?
So I did that semester, which, you know, it went from August to December. And then I did another Inside Out course, which was the next semester, January through May. And I took that one at Hoffman Hall. That's, you know, around like Erie Avenue in the city. Mm-hmm. I did about a year of it, two semesters.
Any long-term commitments or long-term ramifications that came from those two semesters? Because it sounded like they were quite impactful.
Honestly, in one of the courses, and it's by happenstance, it was a student I met in the first course. And of course, you know, because of rules of the program and of the prison, you know, you don't make friends with anybody in the course. But it just so happened that one of the gentlemen in that first course, I was going on a visit some years after, and I seen him in the visiting room. I was going to visit my stepdad. He was in the visiting room. He recognized me. You know, we struck up a conversation. And, you know, I, to this day, am helping him with his commutation application. He is someone who is serving 25 to 50 years. He has an exemplary record while he's been in there. He hasn't been in trouble. So I am helping him navigate the process for commutation.
Nice. So again, that same theme, while still going back there to work for the folks that you were raised with and see what you could do to help. I tell you, that's that spirit that I just can't say enough about. I'm looking also here at that you won the Phoenix Award in May of 2013 when you completed your undergraduate. You got the Phoenix Award. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
Absolutely. So the Phoenix Award is given to a criminal justice student who has distinction in major, meaning within that major they have a 3.8 or higher, and also who has faced some adversity and managed to rise above that adversity. Mentioned much of that adversity here.
Right, that certainly is you.
And one of the professors specifically took a strong interest in me. Her name is Dr. Nicole Van Cleve. We still talk frequently.
Nice.
And she, you know, she didn't know much of my background, but she always says that she saw something in me. And once we sat down, she said, "Hey, you are exactly who I thought you were." And this was just from my interactions in her classes. I took every class she offered, from Nature of Crime to Criminal Courts, every class she offered. She was a wonderful professor. And again, she, you know, once I got to talk to her on a personal level, she said, "Hey, you're exactly who I thought you were." And she took a strong interest in liking in me. She is the one who suggested that I attend law school when I thought that was like so far-fetched. I'm like, "What do you mean? Like, how am I going to do that?" She set me up to go over to Temple Law and speak to, you know, the admissions office. And they brought the idea of the part-time program to me. And that was what made it very real for me.
Wow. And you know what? That was really what my next question was going to be. What made you decide to go to law school? But before that, you were at St. Joe's University in the Masters of Science in Criminology program. So that was after you finished undergraduate at Temple.
I'll explain that trajectory there. That honestly was all of me telling myself, "Hey, you can't do this." It was a little self-defeat. I didn't want to take the LSAT. So instead of buckling down and studying and taking the LSAT, I said, "Oh, I'll go do this master's program because I know if I leave school, then maybe I won't go back." So honestly, that graduate program that's meant to be 2 years, I finished it in 1 year after I took the LSAT and seen that I had a great enough score to get into law school.
Wow. But you started it, so that's why you had to finish it. I know you.
Exactly.
Once you got into it, you were like, okay, I'll figure out what's next, but I'm going to finish anything I start.
Exactly.
Oh,
yep.
My goodness. So tell us a little bit about some of the careers that you've maintained, because what I found was one of the things that drew me directly to you as the law clerk was the fact that you had a lot of nonprofit organization work. So tell us a little bit of that. You worked juvenile justice system. Like, tell us a little lot about that.
Yeah. So my career path.
Yes.
So after undergrad, my first position was working within the juvenile justice system. I did some work at St. Gabe's and reintegration. That was very tough, I will say, because I think we kind of glossed over the fact that my 16-year-old brother, he was murdered in 2008.
Yes.
So for me, and honestly, at the time he was murdered, my mother had gone to the court after he had been in trouble for some truancy issues and said, hey, I need help. They said, well, he really hasn't been in trouble yet, so we can't help him. So that was, you know, why I started with juvenile justice. And it was honestly within the courtrooms with those juveniles and, you know, how they were treated, how they were talked to. That was another, you know, strong inclination that I wanted to go to law school. It was just support for what, you know, my undergrad professor told me she saw in me. So I started in juvenile justice. I did some human service work with DHS, you know, working with dependent children whose home lives weren't sustainable. And a lot of this stuff honestly relates to my own background. You know, like, these are things that I experienced, and, you know, I should probably help someone with these things. I recognize that they're barriers, they're issues. That's my thought process a lot of times in taking positions. I did some more nonprofit work, working with juveniles who have been involved in the justice system, but working to get them resources, you know, in the form of monetary resources, education. It was a, you know, Federal Department of Labor grant. So for me, it was more focused on numbers than the actual help. That was probably a deterrent for me in working, you know, on those type of grants. I was able to do some of the work I like to do, but ultimately I felt like it was too focused on the numbers. I've also done some work in residential treatment facilities, which would be more so in the mental health side of working with juveniles. And many people who know me, they just can't understand what I enjoy about working with kids who like to fight and hit you and throw things at you. I love those kids. they need the help. They need someone who cares and who understands them. So, I mean, I've been all around criminal justice field with juveniles, with adults, and the mental health field with children. I've done plenty of things, but I like to think that all of this work ties together.
It does. It absolutely does. And you know, not to kind of out you on certain things, though, when you were a kid, I heard you knew how to throw some hands yourself.
Yes. I was a fighter, and I wouldn't say that I started fights, but I always knew how to finish them.
I know that's right. I am not mad at you for that. I know that's right. So tell us a little bit about your path to TSF and how you found, you know, being a law clerk for me and what had to make you stop. I mean, obviously I know that, but our listeners don't. So give us
sure.
a little bit of information about, you know, how it was to you know, a lot of people say working for me, I'm a bit of a taskmaster, and I'm sure that's true. So, and now you can tell me everything that you thought about it, because you're no longer under my employ.
Well, I will first say that I would never have thought that there would be quite the intersectionality between law and, I guess you can say, human services. And when I say that, I mean, your courtroom is run like no other. the fact that I was able to not only, you know, work in that legal arena and, you know, do the things that weren't too sexy, like write opinions, but also help these very real men and women that come into the court by giving them resources and helping them, you know, be successful. I never thought that that would occur. So working in your courtroom, it was, I mean, it was wonderful for me. And I like to think that we're on the same wavelength. We think about things the same, in most aspects. So, I mean, it was just a reinforcement that the way that I worked and, you know, the things that I thought were right and true were, I think our fit was, it was just so organic.
It really was.
And, you know, but for someone working hand in hand with us, they wouldn't understand it.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. My daughter actually hears this part of the segment. It got to the point where I would get up in the morning and make sure that we both had lunch, because you would just work straight through, and I used to just work straight through. And so when I would just grab a snack here and there, I used to always fix lunch to design to make sure that we both ate. You remember that? And that would be the best.
Oh, you sure did. Talk. Listen, I'm missing it now. I don't have anyone to make lunch for me. but no, I mean, the bonding we did in that short amount of time is honestly the reason I could never walk away from Judge Sawyer's courtroom. And I had to be involved in some aspect. You know, I tried my hardest in other ways to be involved, and that didn't pan out. But when the opportunity presented itself for the position of executive director, I'm like, well, I mean, hey, this is what you want. I mean, you're still going to be able to make a profound impact in Judge Sawyer's courtroom without actually physically being there every day.
Well, you do. You still make a profound impact in my courtroom, because, you know, the interns that are here, and my secretary, Ariel, she still calls you all the time, doesn't she?
I talk to Ariel almost every weekday. And I won't say that it's all about work every time we speak, but I will say that I still help her greatly.
and some of the issues that
come up, they don't make it to you because I've walked her through them.
But honestly, I feel it. And what I really love about it is that this is our way of mentoring, because you know, Ariel is a finished college, and she's trying to get into law school, and she's trying to kind of get where you are in life, in that you finished law school, in that you have a plan of moving forward. That, you know, in terms of the executive director position for the Sentencing Foundation, you know, in a few years, I keep saying that we're going to grow to a place that you're not going to be working for anybody else, because we're going to be able to grow to a place that only your stewardess can actually, you know, get to. You know what I mean?
I'm with you on that. Listen, I'm in it for the long haul. When that day gets here, I will be the most ecstatic.
Because it's on its way.
That's the work that I want to do.
Well, I promise you, it is on its way. You know, not only with being able to connect with our listeners, because that's ultimately what we need to do, right? We need to do it, then talk. And so that's why, you know, we started doing the resource-based sentencing supervision in my courtroom. That's why we started the Sentencing Foundation, because, you know, so much has been talked about in trying to reduce recidivism. But this is another reason why this show is called Crime Prevention for Real. Because, you know, you've been in this space. Like, what mm-hmm. are some of the ways that you've seen people attempt to say they want to work with juvenile justice or work with recidivism reduction, but they still don't have the impact that we're looking for? Like, so I'm sure you've been through a lot of programs like that. Tell our listeners a little bit about some of those other kinds of attempts at crime reduction programs.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure everyone knows they put out grants all the time. And it's like, hey, you know, how can you help our juveniles? We have this gun problem. We have this violence problem in our city. I mean, everyone has these great ideas. Oh, we're going to start this, you know, this group here at the rec center, and we're going to have them come in and do groups. But I find that people don't have longevity. They don't you know, have what it takes to do this day in and day out, even when people don't show up or even when they get pushback. They're not in it for the long haul. You know, it's going to take some time. They don't have what it takes to, you know, keep moving forward. It's once they see one setback, you know, that's it. So, of course, those grants and all those things, they look good on the front end. Oh, I'm going to get this much money. I can help this many people. But you have to be relatable to those juveniles. That's one of the things I took pride in when I worked with juveniles. You know, they throw around the slang, and when I know what it means, they're all surprised. Like, right. Well, what do you mean? Like, of course I know what you're saying. Or, you know, they listen to certain music, and, you know, I know the song. Like, okay, you have to make yourself relatable. And I'm not talking about, you know, like a forced relatable where, you know, you're saying things and you look crazy. It has to be organic. Yeah, and, you know, that's where I come from. I'm from West Philly. You know, I've been, you know, around. So, you know, I know things, and they're very surprised by it. But once they see that I'm relatable, then they feel very comfortable talking to me, you know, expressing themselves to me. And I've always found that to be, I like to say, my carrot and my in with the juveniles.
Well, you know what? How do you strike that balance? Because when you talk about the juveniles that you work with, because you can relate to them and that you can meet them where they are, but your children are not like that at all. So the children that you work with and the children that you raise, I don't think that your children would be able to. Well, maybe Hondo, but I don't think, generally speaking, that your children would be able to relate to a lot of the children that you work with in your work with your work hat on.
You're absolutely right. My children aren't. They come from a different place. It's weird because I haven't, you know, lived amongst, you know, those individuals for some time, but it's something that's still very relatable for me. It's just something that's within me that allows me to, you know, reflect back and say, okay, I understand this. I mean, even now when I say certain, you know, hit terms that are popular, my kids will crack up laughing because they like, one, how do you even know that? Why are you saying that? I'm like, yeah, you didn't think I knew that, did you? I don't know. It's just something that just comes natural.
Well, you know, I think it's more like, you know, they say that or at least, you know, a lot of the psychoanalysts and behavioral health folks, they say that most people's potential or their core of who they are, it gets formed from 0 to 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so from 0 to 7, that's what you looked around and saw until you saw a different life at Girard College. And then you straddled those two worlds by going back and forth on the weekends and the weekdays. But I think that had a lot to do with, I guess we should explain to our listeners also here in the city, if they're saying, well, if they love each other so much, why is she not a law clerk anymore? So I think
it
bears some explanation. I'll let you say. I'm still here at the First Judicial District, so I'll let you explain it.
Sure. So I mean, there's a residency requirement that if you work for the First Judicial District, you live within the city limits. You know, for some time now, over 15 years, I have not lived in Philadelphia. One of the main reasons is because, you know, after my brother was murdered because of a neighborhood feud, I felt like it probably wasn't the best place for me to raise my children. As I stated before, I have two boys, and, you know, this world can be a very scary place for African-American boys. I do live, you know, in the suburbs, in the county, and I did make a 1-hour commute back and forth to the city every day when I worked for the court. You know, I grappled with that and making a choice to not return to the city. There was a time where I felt like, well, hey, I think I can move to the city. Maybe it won't be so bad. But, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, it would mean, you know, uprooting my kids from what they know. And it would make it, you know, a bit more difficult. You know, their lives are centered around the area where we live and have lived. It would have been a very harsh adjustment for them. So again, it was a very difficult decision, but I decided that I would not move back to the city. And with that, I was not allowed to, you know, maintain my status as an employee with the First Judicial District.
Exactly. And I have to say that, you know, without obviously getting into you know, those are the policies, those are the procedures. But when you had to prioritize what was best for your children over the job, I couldn't do anything but respect you for it, right? I in fact, my affection kind of grew for you because you made that. What was I disappointed? Sure. Was Arielle disappointed? I think we both shed a tear or two. but at the same time, to say, you know, people give lip service to the priorities they put in their life, right? And when they say that their children are at the epicenter of their life, when they say that the children are at the epicenter of their life, you know, they say it, but then right. they still pick themselves over their children. Right?
They still
pick what they want to do over what's best for their children. And so what ultimately helped me get through having the disappointment of knowing that you had to leave was, it's not that you didn't try, because I even remember you looked for a couple of places and then you looked around the neighborhood and you said, oh my God, you try to imagine your children.
Exactly.
You tried to imagine, could Hondo and Josiah actually thrive here? And when the answer was no, you had to give up the dream of staying on as my law clerk. And so, if nothing else, I can't do anything but applaud you for it. I couldn't applaud at the time because I was still crying. But again, I just wanted our listeners to know that, you are experiencing a love fest between the two of us. The parting of the ways was that you had to. I'm a single parent, and you know, and so I have two kids, right? You know my kids, Julian mm-hmm. and Alicia, and I would have. It's a terrible place to be to put yourself to find yourself, not put yourself, but to find yourself in. But you took it on faith that you would be able to navigate the residency requirement by finding someplace that you could see your kids in. And unfortunately, the last 3 months when you started looking, it just didn't materialize. Every place, you know, every place you looked at wasn't anywhere near the kind of lifestyle that you had gotten them accustomed to. And it would be unfair to expect them to be able to thrive in a situation where they were completely unaccustomed. Could you imagine Josiah in public school here?
Oh my goodness. I couldn't imagine it. I mean, I think I would be anxiety filled every day. My mental wouldn't be in order knowing 100%. That, you know, he was in this, for him, unfamiliar environment. Yeah.
And we already know Josiah might have been mistreated. Hondo might have been locked up because he wasn't going to take that.
Yes, very true. That's very true.
And you know, I love Hondo, but I also know that he would have just been a really toxic situation for both of you.
Sure.
Kids, unless there was a great benefactor that you know put you in a place that the first judicial district wasn't willing to pay for, you know, it just was what it was. But luckily for us, well, I don't know about luckily, the Sentencing Foundation needed a hands-on executive director that was really, really had the appetite for the work, and I couldn't think of a more qualified, better person than you. So where one door, you know, they say one door closes, a window opens.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited. I initially sat down and, you know, wrote up so much like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. But again, I have to remind myself, just as I stated before, these things don't just happen overnight.
Right.
You know, we have to be very, very, you know, cautious with how we take our steps. And, you know, things will pan out.
I'm sure you're right. So tell us a little bit about some of the initiatives that you're working on as the executive director. Let's get into a little bit of that.
Yes. So, I mean, as you know, of course, our biggest driver is the interns. Building up the intern program, you know, to be more sustainable, is not only having more interns, but making sure that their time is spent efficaciously. Right. Getting that intern program to where as though it's interchangeable, you know, with the other jurisdictions. That's, you know, probably my number one priority right now, is working on that intern program. I think we have a great core group of interns, and, you know, it will be a great success if we keep moving how we've been moving. We've been grateful to get, you know, these wonderful interns from, you know, all over the city, whether they're implants or, you know, from the city, they have all been wonderful. Another goal of mine is to get someone from academia to be able to, you know, put our work into numbers, so right. to speak. The professor I spoke about, Dr. Van Cleef, she is on my list of people to talk to. She is from Chicago. She is a criminal justice professor. She formerly worked at Temple, but she now works at Brown University. I think she is going to be my go-to to get that done. Those are just two of the things that are at the forefront, and I think will make a huge difference in the way we progress.
And I tell you something else that we're all that I know that we're also working on is the biggest thing that is at the top of my list, as you know, is getting us to the point where we have that 50 to 100 judges in 25 regions, and knowing that we've already gotten Judge Hernandez as our anchor judge in Texas mm-hmm. is fully engaged and she's fully involved. She's getting us to the place where we are working on the other two Texas judges, one in Houston and one in San Antonio. And so I'm really excited about how we are going to move forward with the Texas Judicial Summit coming up in October. And have you had a chance to really talk with Ariel and get into, you know, who's going to be coming and how we're going to apportion out that summit? Because for our listeners, Texas has a judicial summit for mental health, and the resource-based sentencing and supervision is a trauma-informed program. And when we explain what the Sentencing Foundation's position as the logistical support for resource-based sentencing and supervision, and that the program is a trauma-informed program, they are giving us a slot, and there should be somewhere between 100 and 300 judges there. Any thoughts on what you want to kind of tell our listeners about how we're going to approach that and kind of a situation?
Yeah, so right now we're organizing those great interns I spoke about. We're going to get, you know, as many as we can, and we're going to head down. We're going to, as they say, mobilize the troops. I mean, they're going down fully informed because they're going to get quizzed before they go down and speak on TSF. Yes, they're going to go down with materials. They're going to be readily available to all the judges down there to answer any questions, you know, to get them registered or even to fill out, you know, inquiry forms if they may think they're interested but not really sure. We'll be sure to have something to follow up with them at a later time. But we plan to go down as a team and, you know, just basically provide this information to all of the judges that are in that room or at that conference so that they go back and relay the information correctly, you know, and that expands, you know, our horizon in the arena of judges and trying to get at that number that judge states we need.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to my sister about this, and she made a fabulous suggestion yesterday, and since we hadn't had a chance to talk since last evening, this is as good a time as any to kind of throw it out there so that you can kind of start working on it.
Sure.
Since we are going to be road tripping it down there because we needed to have a nice group of folks that's going to man the Texas Summit is going to be 3 days, and there's going to be a booth that Resource-Based Sentencing and Supervision and Sentencing Foundation will have. And so we will certainly need to bring some interns that will be able to man the booth for us. So we were going to be road tripping it down there. And my sister did a road trip across the country in her college years with her then boyfriend before she her married and had kids with him. And she was saying that the way that they did it was they looked at their starting place and their ending place, and then they charted a path of where they wanted to stop. And so I'm thinking that since it's in October, maybe it might make sense for you to, you know, using the interns, of course, figure out what possible mini little stops that we could make that would be efficacious as well as beneficial to the Sentencing Foundation. And when she said that, I was like, wow, that sounds like a great idea, because instead of just, you know, going straight there. Instead of stopping straight through, you know, because we plan on taking our time, taking a couple of days to get there and a couple of days to get back, as well as the 3 days that we'll spend in Austin, Texas in October. But if we are strategic with it, we could just take an 8 or 9 hour stop someplace along the way and have some connection with somebody that we are trying to work with and that we're getting to know. Like, for example, Judge Friedman, that our latest board member, Asada Thomas, has linked us with, and we'll be seeing her shortly. I would think get a list of those folks that she's familiar with, and that she's familiar with. I'm just thinking out loud about a strategy of making a stop or two down on the way down, and a different but stop or two on the way back.
Right, absolutely. So that sounds like a great idea. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, websites with, you know, events pertaining to our cause.
Exactly.
So I will absolutely take a look at that. That's a great idea.
So I think maybe we should put an intern.
I think that will maximize our potential.
Exactly.
Tremendously.
Exactly. So, but with the last few minutes that we have left here, I would love to hear from you about any other issues that we haven't touched upon here that maybe you might think is interesting to any of our readers, because I'm looking through a lot of the questions that we had and we kind of blew right through most of them.
I mean, anything interesting?
Well, right now, give us a little bit, a sense of the programs that you're working with now.
So currently, I'm working with two different programs. Both of them work with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. However, my role in both of these positions is to prepare them for licensing and conduct investigations into rights violations and things of that nature. Again, this goes back to, you know, more so my personal life and having, you know, an uncle who had intellectual disabilities, and ensuring that, you know, just because someone has an intellectual disability, they should still have a fulfilling life. That's always my goal. So even in doing the work at the top, meaning the administrative work and not the surface level work in the homes and at the sites, I still am able to make sure that, you know, they're getting the best quality of life. And, you know, that's basically making sure that regulations are followed, you know, their money is being spent appropriately. So again, I don't take positions that don't relate to my life and I don't feel like could be helpful for people.
That's actually
what I'm doing right now, while simultaneously being the executive director for TSF. That is what I have going on right now.
But you know what I love about that? That is the intersection of all of the things that you've done, right? Between the social work and the social ethics that you portray, but not even just that. I'm talking about the intersection of the legal, you know, having to deal with having to deal with the regulations, the rules and the regulations, and making sure that there are compliance in the facilities
exactly.
that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And then also doing the investigatory portion, and when people have to appeal and whatever a decision that might be made within that context. So I think that is like it's kind of like social services meets administrative law. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And again, I'm very selective about the positions I choose to take. They have to be meaningful to me. I don't like work that's not meaningful.
I think it's one thing as a single parent that we can kind of agree to. Our kids are not going to do what we tell them. They're going to do what they see us doing. And so for I'm sure that they are so proud of you because I'm so proud of you. I'm proud not just to call you, just a friend, but a friend doesn't cover it. You're more like family. And we know that with the kind of fortitude that we have, the Sentencing Foundation will have that opportunity to make a paradigm shift and how judges sentence and supervise in a way that moves the needle on mass incarceration, because that is exactly the things that we bonded over, and that's why we love you so much. And thank you for spending this last hour with us. And for those of you out there that want to learn more about the Sentencing Foundation and get involved yourself, please go to thesentencingfoundation.org. You can get involved. You will be able to meet Deanna Davis. You'll probably be able to meet myself. And we will also be able to lean in together and actually move the needle on mass incarceration. I think that does it for us today. And thanks, everybody, for out there listening. And I'll see you next time.